welcome to New Books in History. Today we have Professor Amelia M. Glazer, who is Associate Professor of Literature at the University of California at San Diego and Director of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies Program, and also Director of the Jewish Studies Program at UCSD. Dr. Glazer is also author of Jews and Ukrainians in Russia's Literary Borderlands, From the Shtetl Fair to the Petersburg Bookshop. She is also editor with David Weintraub of Protel Pen, America's Rebel Yiddish Poets. Professor Glazer is editor of dozens of scholarly and popular articles, including in the New York Times a few years back about Vladimir Putin and Ukraine. And today we are talking about her new book, Stories of Khmelnytsky, Competing Literary Legacies of the 1648 Ukrainian Cossack Uprising, which came out from Stanford University Press in 2015. The book has 12 contributing authors. Dr. Glazer is one of these. She's also editor of the book and coordinator of the efforts of all of her colleagues. So, Professor Glazer, thank you very much for joining us today, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Could you please tell us, who was this Khmelnytsky, this imposing Cossack leader on the cover of your book? And
yes.
Who do different people say he is?
Yeah, well, it depends who you ask. I think that if you ask a Ukrainian, he was an important figure in Ukraine's history, because Khmelnytsky was really the first person to serve as a leader in defining the territory that we now view as Ukraine. So he's a sort of George Washington figure, if you will. If you ask a Jew, Khmelnytsky's name should be forgotten and blotted out. He's a sort of Haman figure, a precursor to the great anti-Semites of the modern world. If you ask a Pole, he's a complicated figure, but perhaps one to be admired. If you ask a Russian, he's an important ally because he's one of the first people to unite Ukraine with Rus, with Russia, with Muscovy, and so it's it really is. He's one of these figures where his legacy depends on the beholder. And of course, even within Ukraine, I simplified it a bit by saying that Ukrainians would compare Khmelnytsky to George Washington. Among Ukrainians, he's also complicated because for many in the past and even I believe in the present, for many Ukrainians, he presents an enigma, because he ended up ceding the territory that he had conquered to Muscovy. So that's a long answer to a short question.
No, I think it's an even longer question. Would you tell us a bit about the uprising and give us the context of the scenario in which his story plays out?
Yeah, so the Khmelnytsky uprising took place primarily in 1948-1949. It was an uprising by a group of Cossacks, very skilled horsemen, independent and semi-independent warriors who rose up against the Polish magnates, and they had several different demands. The demands involved freedom of territory, freedom to worship, the ability to enlist more Cossacks in the list of registered Cossacks, and Khmelnytsky was the leader. There were, of course, a number of people working under him, but he was the hetman of the Zaporozhian Cossacks, and he to make a very long story short, ended up conquering a large territory and eventually handing this territory over to Muscovy. But of course it was significant that he rebelled against those magnates that were allied with the Polish crown.
So I think the uprising is the, perhaps, as you say, to simplify, the national definitive moment for what we consider Ukrainians. But at that moment, they were part of this sprawling and poly-ethnic Polish-Lithuanian commonwealth with many ethnicities and religions. So as we see in your book, and certainly the Polish sources, it is a disruptive, I guess every creation is also a disruption. Why did he rebel? What were all the things that were going on that propelled him? Was this personal vendetta? Was it bigger identity politics? What are the stakes, would you say, in your investigations and the people you have brought together to comment on it?
Yeah. It's a really kind of fun and complicated question. He, Khmelnytsky actually, the fun story to tell is a personal story. People like personal stories. Readers like personal stories. So the story, for example, that, Sienkiewicz chose to tell in his famous 19th century Polish novel, With Fire and Sword, is a story about a personal vendetta, right? Where, Starosta or a leader by the name of Daniel Chaplinsky had a personal axe to grind against Khmelnytsky, ended up evicting Khmelnytsky from Khmelnytsky's estate, and killed his son. There was a large family battle that ensued, and in response, Khmelnytsky rose up against all of the Poles. So that's kind of a nice, sort of personal narrative. There's a love story involved. There's a woman that Khmelnytsky was in love with, who was taken from him, and so forth. That's always a, kind of the fun personal story, and the one that films well. But my own sense of it, having read multiple accounts, is that Khmelnytsky saw himself as the chosen leader for a group of Cossacks as well as peasants. We can't call them Ukrainian peasants, but we can call them peasants living in that region who were really the lowest on the totem pole. They were made to pay taxes that they didn't have. They were not allowed to practice their religion freely. They were not allowed to become Cossacks, to become Cossack warriors if they wanted to. They were unhappy in general with the system of exploitation, where a large landowner controlled a great number of people who were working the land. So it was a revolution led by Cossacks, perhaps on behalf of others as well. So the larger, more complex story is the harder one to tell, the story that has to do with uncomfortable, let's call them proto-Ukrainians, who are not happy with their lot. But often the fun story to tell is the one that involves a lover who's for whom Khmelnytsky is willing to go to war. But he was the chosen leader for a group of people who were extremely unhappy and did not have rights over the territory that they saw as naturally theirs.
Maybe like George Washington, he can also be everybody to, or everything, everybody. Or I was just thinking of the Sienkiewicz story you just referred to. Maybe he has to have that personal vendetta so that there couldn't possibly be something wrong with the authority structure as it was, that there could be nothing wrong with being a subordinate.
It's a story that works very well. I mean, it especially has worked well in Polish history because, Khmelnytsky, of course, he got along well with the King of Poland for a certain period of time. And you can create a narrative that says, well, maybe it was just personal and it's not that, it's not that he was really undermining the Polish Commonwealth.
But you wrote a chapter here too, and you are dealing with something that's a little bit more monstrous, which is the murder of Jewish civilians, and the stories about that. Would you tell that's a big black mark in the story. Would you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, I'll just back up for a moment too, because I left Jews out of who is Khmelnytsky. I mean, I briefly mentioned Jews, but I guess that will help to tell the story about why I felt this book was necessary. And the perspective that I had come from as a scholar of Russian literature and Yiddish literature, and as someone who had only heard Khmelnytsky's name in a very, very negative context in Jewish circles. My perspective was, you know, how could this horrible villain still be honored? How could there still be a city called Khmelnytsky in Ukraine? How could, how could he still be on the Ukrainian currency? And this was the perspective that I came from as a young graduate student beginning my study of this region 20 years ago. And when I first visited Ukraine, it wasn't my first time in Ukraine, but when I moved to Ukraine in 2002 as a graduate student doing research in that region, mostly on Russian Jewish literature, I was fascinated by this figure of Khmelnytsky, but I was really puzzled that, you know, such a horrible figure could still be, you know, unproblematically honored and revered. And what emerged from that was conversations with friends in Ukraine about the figure of Khmelnytsky, and also a sense of how complicated a single charismatic presence can be. You know, we collectively remember as groups what we need to remember to hold the group together as need be. And for Jews, especially for Jews living in the diaspora, living in outside of Ukraine, rather, Jews need to think about Khmelnytsky as one of many common villains. The fact that the situation was far more complicated than that became a really compelling research topic for me. So I wanted to understand how Khmelnytsky, who certainly massacred or at least oversaw the massacring of thousands of Jews at the least, could still have statues in a country that is, and even then was, attempting to cultivate stronger relationships with Jewish communities, both in and out of Ukraine. So this, you know, this paradox made me very curious to learn more about how the figure's been memorialized in different contexts. So that's, you know, that's the bigger background for why I came to write about this figure, to use this figure as a figure of conflict. And my own chapter takes up a little known, but I find really fascinating play by Nikolai Minsky, a Russian symbolist of sorts. He was a proto-symbolist. He was writing a little earlier than the people that we usually associate with Russian symbolism, like Bloch and so forth, but he, Bielik. Minsky was writing in the 1880s and 90s. He was a converted Jew. He converted to Christianity. But he still was very concerned with the stories that held the Jewish community together. And he wrote this play around the time that the statue of Khmelnytsky was first erected in Kiev in the 1880s. And of course, the statue that was erected in Kiev was a statue that was supposed to celebrate the unity of the Ukrainian territories and Russia. And it was also supposed to celebrate the unity among all Orthodox Slavs. And so Minsky, possibly in response, possibly as a counter to this, decided to write this play about the Khmelnytsky uprisings and the accompanying massacres of Jews. And I think it should be pointed out that even in Minsky's play, Khmelnytsky really doesn't figure in as a character in the play. Khmelnytsky is sort of, you know, he's the overseer. The play is really about a massacre that was led by one of Khmelnytsky's leaders, one of his Cossacks, by the name of Krivonis or Krivonos, who is known as, you know, one of the bigger henchmen of the Cossacks of that period. And so the story that Minsky writes is borrowed directly from Hanover's, Nathan of Hanover's chronicles that were written in the immediate aftermath of the Khmelnytsky uprisings. And as Adam Teller shows in the chapter that he wrote for this volume and elsewhere, Hanover essentially was a historian of his day. He was taking various eyewitness accounts and putting them together, and he came up with this account of the massacres of several different communities, several different shtetls. So Minsky reads Hanover's account, rereads Hanover's account. It had been translated. Hanover's chronicles had been translated into Russian. They had recently been republished, and Minsky was clearly using the Russian translation. And he writes this very compelling play about the uprising in the city of, or rather the massacre in the city of Tulchin. And, you know, it was one of the largest massacres during the uprising. And he brings together several of the different stories that Hanover tells. He brings in some from other episodes. And he, you know, the story really revolves around a rabbi who, you know, didn't want, the Jews to take up arms on the Sabbath, and he didn't want them to take up arms against against the Poles. The Jews and the Poles had made a pact in that town that they would fight together against the Cossacks. And the rabbi said, okay, we need to honor our pact. The Poles didn't. And as a result, the Poles allowed the Cossacks to come in, to capture all of the Jews, and eventually to kill most of them. So Minsky, in his retelling of it, creates a really strange fictional character named Castro, who is a Marrano, a Jew from Spain or from Portugal, I think in this case, who was a man who didn't know about his Jewish background, discovered late in life that he did have some Jewish ancestry, but had to convert in order to actually become Jewish. After he converts, he decides, I must go and save my brethren down in Poland. And so Castro, and this is a totally fictionalized character, Castro goes down to Poland, ends up fighting for the Jews together with the Poles, and becomes this hero figure. And I find it really interesting that that Minsky, a Russian symbolist of Jewish extraction who had converted to Christianity, would take this would create this Spanish Jewish figure as the ultimate figure of strength, who has converted to Judaism in order to symbolize sort of the martyr figure, the outsider martyr Jewish figure who would be strong enough to rise up against the Cossacks. So that's, again, kind of to make a short answer longer.
That's just so curious and endlessly interesting, and I wonder why he created it. Is it because he himself is a convert and he himself feels irascinated, and so he has to imagine that here's another fellow Jew in a distant land who conversion's not the end of it and expulsion's not the end of it and you can move from place to place? What do you think that's about?
Okay, so I mean I'm not sure exactly. It's mystifying, but I think part of what Minsky was doing was turning the Khmelnytsky episode into a parable for his own day, where belief was really the strongest trait. And it really kind of didn't matter if the belief was Christian or Jewish or what. It was all about having some sort of faith and drawing strength from that faith. And he was very mystical. Khmelnytsky was incredible. Minsky was incredibly mystical, and he liked the idea of a figure, Christian or Jewish, or maybe some hybrid, some kind of Christian-Jewish hybrid, who would fight for this idea of belief in God. So rather than having it be a story about the Jews as Jews, the Jews as a people, it's a story about one Jew who has this very strong faith, and it's a strong enough faith to lead him to stand up to a group of Cossacks. I also think it's most of the stories in the volume highlight the admiration that the authors had for the Cossacks, whether or not they liked the Cossacks. So even if the authors of the stories, let's say they were Jewish or Polish, and they felt that the Cossacks were ultimately enemies, there's always this idea that, you know, I wish we were a little more like them. The Cossacks are incredibly heroic. They're incredibly strong. They're sexy. You know, we should all be Cossacks. So I think Minsky as well is valorizing this idea of the Cossack. You know, if only we could fight like them.
they go where the wind blows, and they come and they vanish, and they.
They're the samurais of Ukraine, and and who doesn't want to be a little bit like a Cossack? You know, even a Jew who has grown up thinking about how horrible the Cossacks were to their grandparents or whatever. And you see this in Israel Bartol's contribution to the volume, which is about, you know, he puts forth the theory that some of the early Zionists were modeling themselves, even modeling their fashion after Cossacks, trying to recreate the Cossack myth for the Jews as they moved toward Palestine.
That makes a lot of sense. Just to be, you know, up out of the city and off in the wilds. Very interesting. And that also explains why even their antagonists regard these Cossacks with such admiration and respect, and have a hard time ascribing treason to, or even if it's rebellion, surely it's, you know, a misunderstanding or something like that, because deep down they're all brothers. I wanted to ask you one more thing. You were saying about faith is the operative here more than, say, a confession or a religion. Of course, these Cossacks too are fighting for faith and their Orthodox expression, that their Christian Orthodox expression that they could not do under, or couldn't do until, you know, 1569 in Poland. Or how does is that too is faith? Is it not, or is that just not part of the equation? These two, you know, we're all people of faith fighting these antagonists, but they too are people of faith worshiping God in their tradition.
I think that comes out especially strongly in a later iteration of the Hanover stories of Tolchin and Nemirov. And one of the things that I argue in my chapter in this volume is that a much better known story, the Yiddish novella, Kiddush Hashem, by Sholem Osh, which was written around 1920, is modeled on Minsky's play. And that's an argument that I make by looking at the translation into Yiddish that was done by Avram Raisin in Warsaw just after the turn of the century, right after a series of pogroms. And, you know, it was a time when Sholem Osh was also hanging out in Warsaw. A lot of the Yiddish writers were spending time in Warsaw and the around the Yudlamid Peretz circle. And I'm certain that Osh probably saw a copy of the play in Raisin's translation, and I believe modeled this fairly famous novella after the Minsky play. And for Sholem Osh, who was a really compelling character, those who are familiar with Sholem Osh at all would either know his Jesus trilogy. He wrote a whole trilogy about Jesus and the apostles and Mary, and they were translated into English. They became very famous. Osh was thrown out of the Yiddish socialist foreword for writing so much about Jesus. He was seen as someone who was trying to proselytize as the Jews, and Sholem Osh never converted to Christianity, but he was in fact good friends with a Polish priest. But if he's not known for his Jesus novels, he's known for his very famous play, God of Vengeance, or Gott von Nekoma. There was a Broadway play about the play called Indecent that won a lot of awards last year. So Sholem Osh was very provocative. That play was about a prostitute who falls in love with the daughter of a wealthy pimp who lives upstairs from the whorehouse. And, you know, so he's provoking people on a lot of different levels. You know, his play contained the first lesbian kiss to be staged on Broadway, and all of the actors were arrested. So Sholem Osh, very provocative figure. He writes this novella based on Minsky's play. And the novella comes out just after the second major wave of pogroms of the 20th century, and ends up putting forth this idea that it's really about faith. His story ends, his novel ends with a sort of Jewish Luftmensch standing at a market stand saying, I'm selling faith. And everybody's been killed or kidnapped or, you know, killed themselves. Or, I mean, it's just a horrible, horrible episode that he describes in his novella. But what Sholomash does is takes this idea that these Jews were really warriors for their belief and pushes it a step further. And in fact, there's a scene where the Jews are singing and they're kind of praying to God, and the Cossacks hear them, and the Cossacks end up stopping everything they're doing and listening. So Sholomash actually puts out this idea that the Cossacks and the Jews are both warriors for faith, perhaps on the same level. And interestingly enough, I mean, Sholomash would be cited in a number of speeches by prominent rabbis in the wake of World War II. So there's this idea that Jews dying for their faith is something that took place during the Holocaust and that goes back to the times of Khmelnytsky. So this idea of emphasizing true belief and true connection to God is something that was exaggerated by these modernists, but became very compelling in the modern world, where Jews may not be compelled to think of themselves as Jews in a nationalist sense as much as in a kind of, you know, multinational American cosmopolitan religious sense. So interestingly enough, the faith comes out helped along by these Jews who had very strong curiosities about Christianity.
That's a remarkable, remarkable connection. And I know that you only have a couple minutes, but can I ask you about Ukraine today? You've written a bit about that in the New York Times and other places. And in the introduction to your book, you write that the Cossacks are again the symbol for both sides in this Ukrainian struggle, and the Russian sympathizers and the pro-Western, independent-oriented Ukraine. And what do you say? And I know that the sort of the Russian gendarmes that go around whipping demonstrators with horse whips, you know, take on the name of Cossacks. And how do you find that symbol in 2018 and 2017 and 16 and 15? Employed.
I mean, I struggled with this a little bit because the book came out. We certainly didn't plan it this way. The book I had conceived of the idea for this volume. The book came out in 2015. I believe it was 2012. We had an initial conference to talk about all of the different contributions, and then as the book was being prepared for publication, Maidan broke out in 2013, 2014, and the war started. And I was just putting the finishing touches into the introduction and was thinking about the role that Cossacks were playing both on the Maidan and in the Donbass. And we have to remember that Cossacks were initially mercenaries. There were a number of different Cossacks. There were different groups of Cossacks. The Khmelnytsky uprising was an uprising by Zaporozhian Cossacks. There were also Don Cossacks that were further to the east. And these Cossacks were often willing to go to war for various groups. Khmelnytsky was, as a leader, was highly educated. He was, in a sense, a kind of cosmopolitan. He certainly would have spoken multiple languages. He probably spoke, you know, French, Polish, Ukrainian, Russian, Latin, you know, a number of languages, probably Turkish. And these were people who were warriors. And the idea that you can still have Cossacks fighting for you, sure, you know, why not? Everybody can kind of claim their Cossacks. It works out particularly well in the current struggle because there were Don Cossacks who were always a little bit closer to Russia, and the Zaporozhian Cossacks who were really in the heartlands of Ukraine and who were always seen as the proto-Ukrainian warriors. And I think that the separatists, as well as Russia, would be hard-pressed to claim that Zaporozhian Cossacks would be fighting for Russia today. But they could make this claim that Don Cossacks might be. I think the idea of wanting Cossacks to be on your side is one that, that is somewhat natural for these contemporary warriors in a currently incredibly tragic conflict.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It has been a great pleasure to talk with you and a tremendous pleasure to read this book. And I have more questions than I have answers, but that's always true with a good book. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for your thorough reading of it. I really am honored. Thanks.